offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. As always, you're being joined by Brother Prem, myself Prem, and Brother Hari from the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust. And we are in the last discourse of the 1991 Summer Course series. In the first season of Shravanam Mananam, we went through the 1990 Summer Course series. This time it's the 91. There are 13 discourses in all. This is the 13th one, and we just started it last week. So before we summarize what Swami said in the clip which we played last week, and the little part that we wanted to speak about as a starter for this week, and before we play the clip for this week too, let's begin by offering our loving pranams and inviting Hari to join all of us. Sairam Hari.
Sairam Prem.
And I think last week predominantly it was just that Padyam part of the discourse, where Swami sang four Padyams, and we actually had the opportunity to speak only about two, a little bit of the third one. Because a very beautiful starting for the discourse, where Swami literally defines what makes Indian culture special. Or rather, if at all you wish to celebrate Indian culture, you should celebrate it for these four points.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important thing which Swami started off with. Because one thing which Swami would constantly emphasize is, there is no point in being proud of being Indian if you do not follow these virtues.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know how many of us really, a lot of us fall into that category. That we have the pride, but we don't have the pride for the right things. So in that sense, Swami says that these are four qualities which literally define Bharatiya nature, which is patience, the value of truth, and selfless love, and honor being more important than even life. And that's the definition that Swami gave. Right?
True, true. Again, like I think, if I recall that one of the prominent themes in the summer course, first summer course that I attended, which was in the year 2000, Swami stressed a lot on forbearance,
right.
On the forbearance, kshama, or forbearance as a virtue. Like, so patience and forbearance are pretty close, because the one thing is forbearance must not be confused with a sense of resignation. That nothing can be done. It is, you know, more a sense of like biding for the right time,
right.
Or a sense of trusting the Lord that whatever is happening for the right reasons, or whatever is happening is for our good,
right.
Or, you know, having complete faith in Swami that He's taking care of things, and therefore it is the right thing that is happening to us, you know, at this moment. So that, in that sense, patience, not in the sense of resignation. Right. So that nothing can be done, right?
Like, right.
So, because in one is an empowering kind of idea, you know, that forbearance or the thing that Swami is taking care, it still has you in a positive frame of mind to deal with whatever is happening. You'll find that there are avenues for action opening up.
Right.
But if you are in a state of resignation, you are like, you know, completely left with a depressed state of mind, saying
absolutely
that nothing can be done.
Right.
So there is a difference.
I think there was another discourse, again one of the summer course discourses, maybe in the 70s, where again Swami uses almost these very qualities to define the quality of Bharatiya nature. Where Swami speaks about forbearance, and when speaking about forbearance, Swami says it comes from a very strong belief in the infallibility of the karma theory. Swami says, and I think there he explains that precisely what you were saying. It's not about resigning to the fact that destiny is supreme and you cannot do anything about it, but it's more like the positivity that I have the ability in my power to change my destiny too, because it's all in the way we act.
Right.
You know, Swami said that the belief that good will be returned for good,
yes,
and the belief that whatever I'm suffering comes from what I have done, and that should give you that forbearance and patience, a kind of an acceptance of what you are, and the positivity to change what you are through your own actions.
Right. Because one thing you should understand with karma is not that, so most people think of it again with a sense of resignation, right? But, and or they equate it with like punishment or reward system.
Right.
It is, as one divine master said, that the suffering is optional. but the learning is inevitable.
Right.
Right. And so if, you know, it's not that we have ordained suffering for ourselves, so God has ordained suffering for ourselves. It is that we have taken on a certain lesson to be learned. And if by our maturity, or if by the learning of the sacred texts, or by listening to the words of a guru, right, we are able to imbibe the lesson, then that suffering becomes like an optional thing. And that's where Swami says, no, my grace comes in and I moderate it. That's why it is very important, therefore, to keep listening to the wise counsel of a guru, or of an elder, or of the scriptures.
Right.
That's the modifying factor.
Right. And then Swami spoke of truth, and Swami very beautifully said, you know, among all the disciplines that one can follow, or all the penance that one can do, the shining jewel is that of truth. And I mean, the way Swami has defined truth is very, very deep. It's not just about the spoken truth, but you know, Swami elsewhere, he says, you know, the spoken truth is an expression of a fearless mind. Where when you don't have anything to hide, when you don't have any guile in your mind, it'll be very natural for you to speak the truth. As somebody was once saying, one of my teachers was saying in class, that you know, if I ask you what's your name, spontaneously you'll tell me your name. There is no necessity for you to hide your name or to speak an untruth. So she was saying that our spontaneous nature is to speak the truth, but only when fear comes in or the other emotions come in, that's when we hesitate to speak the truth. So Swami speaks of truth as an expression of we being established in the real truth, that truth which is beyond the change of time. And then of course Swami spoke of love, and Swami did not just say that love is one of the aspects. Swami said it's nothing is more sweeter than mother's love. And I think suggesting that the selfless aspect of love, it's not the love that we see in merely what we see in interpersonal relationships as a form of attraction or affection. Swami is talking about the higher quality of love, of selfless love. And then of course honor. I think that is again something which Swami is going to talk about in the clips to come. But we spoke of how Swami would give a lot of importance to that. The honor is more important than freedom in a sense. You know, it is more important than liberty or your entitlements. You know, what is my duty? And if I don't do my duty, it is a dishonor to myself. And that, the self-respect which is born out of you being, you adhering to dharma, is something which Swami would speak of very often. Right? And the next poem was, of course, where Swami spoke about how each country has its own set of code of conducts. It has its own approach to life. And it's important that when you bring in those ideas into your country, it does not shake the foundations of your country. Mm. I mean, you can always learn and absorb from other countries. I think that's one of the aphorisms in Rig Veda, right? Let all good come from all directions.
Bhadram karne bishwanayama deva,
right.
Bhadram pashye.
Exactly, what we start our Vedam chanting with.
True.
But it should not shake the foundation of your culture. That's what Swami was saying.
Yeah, assimilation of values, or assimilation of something that adds, enriches and contributes to what the Indian culture stands for. You know, that Swami himself was never against. You know, sometimes if you read a sentence like that goes like, the ideals of India have been destroyed by the adoption of foreign values. This is what we were talking about yesterday, that Swami wasn't against Western ideals as such.
Right.
Right? Because there were things of interest in that. That, you know, he would actually point out and say that this we should learn. This we should learn.
Right.
Right, so because of this, we must have a better understanding of what Swami means when he says that the ideals of India have been destroyed by the adoption of foreign values.
Mm. Right. In fact, you know, many times when you read this, I think a lot of our listeners also had made this observation that what Swami speaks of these values, it's, I mean, I think in the starting of the discourse, Swami mentions that all cultures and all kinds of learning have these values.
Yeah.
They are like part of the thing. And that's why if you see, these are not values which are specific to India, but any civilization of worth which we look up to today. I mean, the civilizations which have, which are not existent today, but any cultural civilization which we talk about were based on these values. And I think when Swami says that you should ensure that these values don't dry up in India, it is also a suggestion that you can see this very actively being practiced in many, many parts of India. May not be in the cities which are becoming more and more modern, but Swami would say that villages still have these values ingrained in them.
Correct.
And you should ensure that doesn't go away from there.
Right.
The two other verses which Swami referred to, and we did not have the time to go into, is where Swami was saying that performing charity and sacrifices ceaselessly, acquiring knowledge and power and harnessing crops and managing lands and all of such things are only for merely filling the stomach. And I think that was a very interesting thing where Swami says even performing charity and sacrifices is for filling the stomach.
True.
Right?
I actually, when I first went over that sentence, I was like, it is at odds with the rest of, you know, when you say acquiring knowledge and power we get, like harnessing crops, ruling over lands, these are actions that are merely for filling the stomach. But when we talk about charity and sacrifices, so I was always wondering, like, where does that fit in? But one thing we must understand that, I think Swami is talking about the intent with which the charities and sacrifices are performed. Even we have seen that differentiation in where the Upanishads speak about the Chandraloka and the Suryaloka. So Swami is distinguishing between such ritualistic acts which are performed for benefits to be accrued in the material world as against the benefits that we seek, which are actually with an objective to come closer and closer to divinity itself. Mm. So Swami is distinguishing, as far as I can interpret, between these two, the actions performed. So just as even the Upanishads, they classified even the study of Vedas and Upanishads, even that was spoken of as paravidya, because the moment you reduce that to a concept, you reduce that to scholarship, or you reduce that to oratory, it now pertains to the worldly level. It is still remains paravidya and not the aparavidya, which would be the seeking of the self.
In fact, I think Swami even made a reference to pranava in that same context, where he said merely by chanting pranava, even the mantra which is so esoteric, merely by chanting it you get only worldly benefits.
Yeah.
If you understand its value in chant, you get heaven and benefits in afterlife.
Correct.
But it is only when you literally chant it in a very selfless manner, just purely for the joy of it, that is when you get the ultimate benefit that even that mantra is there to give. Similar to what Swami is telling about charity and things like that. I mean, it's a wake-up call for us that even charity, we do it with the idea of filling our stomach in some way or the other. And that's what Swami is suggesting. Then Swami goes on to say that what is the point of doing this when even the worms, birds and beasts do it for the same purpose. Even they do whatever they do for filling their stomach and for survival. If we still are stuck in that mode of survival, then what is the point in claiming that we are better off as humans?
And for Swami, human life was that valuable, no? He would say, Jantu naam narajanma durlabham. And that is to say that among all the species, the being born as a human is something that is very, very rare and special. And so Swami is to say, therefore, that this opportunity must be utilized. And of course, what differentiates a human life from an animal life? Because looked at it that way, a human is still a mammal, very much a part of the animal kingdom. But with the faculty of discrimination, right, or with the faculty of being able to work oneself out of the circumstances, environment that we are born in, right? So that is the faculty of discrimination that has been provided to us, and Swami expects us to utilize that that faculty completely.
And interesting thing is Swami saying that if you also do the same thing of filling your stomach, you are not, Swami is not saying you are at the level of the beast, but you become inferior even to the other living beings. So it's almost suggesting that you have a grand opportunity. If you make use of the opportunity, you raise higher.
Yeah.
But a misuse of this opportunity actually makes you lower than even the other beings which are below
you. Because Swami used to say, if you look at an animal, like it acts true to its nature.
True to its nature.
Whereas if you look at a human, the human is endowed with various faculties. And the moment you decide to, disregard the the improvement or discriminating kind of faculties that you have, you actually become subhuman.
Right.
Or even lesser than the animals. Or it's obvious to put it very, you know, humorously, is to say fish is better than selfish. Right. So it's to say that that is its nature. Mm-hmm. But here you are demeaning even below that. Right?
So in fact, there's one beautiful Chinnakatha which Swami says, mm-hmm. may not be directly related to the preciousness of human birth, but it's about when you know the value of something and you don't give it its due importance.
Mm.
There is this Chinnakatha Swami says about this shepherd boy who has this duty of taking this herd of sheep every day to the meadows and, you know, allow them to graze and then bring them back home. And he has one lamb in that herd which is completely black in color and it's his favorite lamb. So one day when he is going around, he finds this shiny little object in the ground. So he picks it up, it's basically a diamond. He doesn't realize that it's such a valuable thing, but it's all glittering in that sunlight. So what he does, he ties it in a rope, in a small thread, and he puts it around this black lamb. And he loves that contrast, you know, it's a black lamb and this shining object hanging around its neck. So every day he would still take this herd and he would look at the scene of this black lamb and that shining object, and it would give him a lot of joy. So one day what happens is there is this a caravan which is going by of a jewelry merchant, and he sees that something is glittering in the eye from, you know, the meadows, and the moment he gets this glitter, he realizes it's a precious stone. Okay, and so he gets attracted to it. He comes searching for this thing, and then he sees the sign of the sight of this lamb with that precious diamond tied around its neck. So he goes up to this boy and says, "You know, boy, can you give me that stone? I'll give you 10 rupees for that." Okay. And the boy says, "No, it looks nice on that lamb, I want to keep it." So then this man tries to tempt the boy and he says, "I'll give you 100 rupees for that." So this boy says, 100 rupees is a bit too much to deny. So he says, "Okay, you can take it." And the story goes, that Swami says, that he gets the diamond, and the moment he picks up the diamond, it bursts into smoke and it vanishes. And then he hears the voice of the diamond speaking to the merchant. And apparently the diamond tells the merchant that, "You know, that boy did not know my value. So I don't mind being mistreated by a person who does not know my value." And he says, the moment you looked at me, you knew my value. And you are undervaluing me even after knowing my value." And he said, "You don't deserve to have me."
Hmm.
Right? And Swami says, the moment you recognize that something is precious, then it becomes your responsibility to live up to that opportunity that you've got.
Correct.
Right? And I think that's what Swami says, that if knowing that being a human being is precious and you don't live up to that, you not only become a beast, but you actually become lower than that. Right?
Yeah.
The other part which Swami spoke of, which will lead on to the discourse which Swami is going to, the clip which you're going to play now, is where Swami spoke about righteousness or dharma being a form of measuring the welfare in the society. The both ways, right? Swami said the education, if the masses in the society is well educated, it will express as dharma. And if dharma is upheld in the society, it will reflect as prosperity in that society. So Swami was giving, I think that is where we stopped, right?
Yeah.
Mm. Right. So I think, sorry?
No, I was mentioning that Swami spoke about the components, you know, of education.
Right, right.
That is acharam, behavior, sampradayam, culture, religion, matam, art, kala and knowledge. And these are not empty statements, because Swami used to expose students to every single aspect of this. Acharam was something where Swami himself would demonstrate. You know, mm-hmm. you were mentioning Kodaikanal, and Swami would give every student the opportunity of like serving or performing other duties, and Swami used to watch like a mother, you know. So it was not a detached view, okay, just go and serve. Mm-hmm. Swami would educate them and train them what was the right order, you know, where an item should be kept, when should it be brought, and how it should be served. And Swami used to be so very observant of these things. In fact, I can recall my very the first few days of being a student over here. So one opportunity we used to all look out for was when Swami would call us for prasadam distribution. Mm. Because especially on a Sunday, Swami would himself call and he would take us into the interview room and he would ask us to pick up the, personally supervise, you know, picking up the cartons, etc. So that was some interaction that we used to look forward to. And the very first time I remember when Swami called us, and Swami told asked me and another person that we should distribute to the doctors and to the guests who are sitting on the veranda.
Okay.
So what happened, I picked up a few of these of the prasadam in my hand and I was just about to go and give it, you know, like hand it over to each one of them. Swami immediately stopped me. He said, come. So I went near him and Swami kept saying bag, and I couldn't understand what Swami was saying, but his attendant got it immediately. He rushed inside the interview room and came out with a plastic cover. So Swami was saying, when you're distributing, you should not just, you know, take it by hand. There's a certain sensitivity involved. You should have it in a bag and take it out, you know, very graciously. You should offer to the guests. So that etiquette, the small aspects of being sensitive.
Right.
And so that Swami used to train, and used to train personally. Many, you know, those who are very fortunate to you know, accompany Bhagwan on some of these trips, they'll have so many such stories of Swami indicating or training them in how you know, you should behave in society.
Right. In fact, talking about prasadam distribution, one thing is the sight which always stays in our mind is Swami sitting in that third block, I mean, in the portico there, and you would be distributing to devotees. And many times we would face this. There would be a lot of devotees there. Because Swami is sitting there, they wouldn't like to take their eyes off Swami. They'll be constantly looking at Swami. And when you go out to distribute, you tend to feel that, you know, if people have not got, they will ask. Right, but when you go out into the devotee section and start distributing, so many times devotees will not ask. They will just wait till you come and personally give it to them. So, and Swami will be watching. If you miss somebody, then you have a very good chance that you will be pulled up for not distributing properly.
And that person could be sitting
right
somewhere in the middle, not
right
in front,
right,
somewhere in the middle of the crowd. I've seen this
exactly
happen. Or Swami would say, you know, you have missed people at the back, which would be true. Like,
exactly,
know,
and so many times it would be perfect.
Yeah, and there is very little chance of, you know, that communication coming
right
down to
Swami.
To Swami to say, you know, this has been missed. So he used to personally stand, supervise and watch who did not get, who has got, you know.
Right.
So,
and it used to be quite a task, because one thing is the block will be packed. You cannot walk very carelessly. You can't step on somebody by mistake. So you have to watch your step. And you have to keep looking around if everybody is God. You have to keep asking around and then moving forward. And Swami will be watching you. Prying eyes of Swami, you could feel it on your back, even though you're not looking at Swami. But, you know, what a lesson it was in all this.
Yeah.
In fact, even in Kodaikanal, Swami would tell them. Because very often Swami would take students along with him to other people's houses. Swami used to be very particular about, you know, when you're a guest at somebody's house, you should be very careful of what you're asking for. You should ensure that you don't make the host feel uncomfortable in any manner. You know, you don't demand for things. And even when you're asking for something which is not on the table, you should be very sensitive in the way you ask. You should not make them feel that, oh, I've forgotten this, or oh, how silly of me not to have given you this. So Swami used to keep watching, you know, what, even if you're asking for salt, Swami will, you know, will watch how are you asking for that. And it should not appear like you're demanding for something, and all of these things. And it's the other way around when you are the host, that you should not leave anything missing on the table so that person will have to ask for it. Right. And that's the culture part of it. And I think we were speaking about that last week also, when we said, you know, truth is one thing, spoken truth is one thing, but how do you practice the value of speaking truth always when you're in society is a completely different thing. There was this a serial I was watching on TV where there is this man who's he's basically a student of ethics and philosophy and all of that. He studies all these philosophers. And there is this one philosopher, I think, who says that at any point in time you should never speak untruth. And that is supposed to be the cardinal sin in ethics. So he is so obsessed with that. And by mistake, one of his friends asks him for an opinion, and he tells a pleasing opinion which is actually untrue.
Mm.
And he's not able to sleep after that. So, and then one of his friends tells him, he said, see, you should not forget that the person who gave that code of conduct about ethics that you should never speak untruth, he was a very lonely man. I don't know who he was referring to. He said that philosopher, yeah. He wrote the whole book sitting in solitude, not right. being disturbed by anybody. So yes, what he said was true, but when you go out, the fact that you should not displease another person also has to be factored in.
True.
I think that is what was the difference when Swami said that all sciences talk about truth, but when you talk about Indian culture or any culture for that matter, it also factors in the idea of behavior and culture and what the others around will think. And, yeah.
You know, so which is why Swami used to emphasize, you know, he used to use this word called knack, you know, he says,
knack, it, right.
You should have that ability, or you should at least acquire the ability to put forward or convey your point in a way that, you know, does not put off the other person, which is a very important thing. See, what happens with most of us is, say you are part of a group, you want to take some initiative, you want to improve something. What we tend to do is put forth the idea, you know, sometimes in a defensive way and sometimes in an over-aggressive fashion. But at no point are we really interested in carrying the group with us. You know, we command, right? Or we suggest. But we never enroll or, you know, have other people join us in that particular idea. We don't place emphasis on that part of the communication.
Right.
Right? And that is why many projects, as they say, you know, they remain ideas. Either they have not been communicated so that well as to have everybody feel inspired that yes, we should do this.
Right.
That is one aspect. Or the other aspect is where it has been shoved down their throat so that out of resentment, pure resentment, they don't take it forward. You know? So that is one very important thing that this edict carries. No? So, na bruyat satyam apriyam. It is not to say that you hold back what you have in or what you want to say. Because sometimes a straight communication is what benefits the person the most. But what is the intent? You know, the intent is that the person should maybe improve, benefit. That is a part which we forget.
Right.
I remember a lady, you know, once after a talk that I gave in the satsang hall here, she came to me with one conundrum, you know.
Okay.
The usual conundrum which any ethicist would face, that she said that she was working in a particular company and her director had given her a task, right, where it required her to do a, you know, a certain unethical act. Not illegal, but then unethical, right? And she said that, you know, I directly said I will not do it. And the person threatened to send me out of the job. What would you do in that situation? And it was something that I had to ponder over for quite some time. You know, what was the missing thing? So I even asked someone elder to me, I asked, what should you do in such a situation? Because I have worked all my life in Sathya Sai Central Trust where I would never have to face such a situation. It would be an unknown situation to us. So when that lady said, see, it's easy to say on the one hand that we should refuse because it is my dharma. You can make a speech like that and say, my dharma dictates, I should not do. And that is one natural reply. But again, the exigencies of the situation, that a very realistic thing called, I'll be out of favor with my boss. So is that an action that I should take? So there are two interesting things that emerged. One thing is, what was missing is the communication where you carry the boss along with you, where you say that, you know, that this is the, if we do this kind of action, it has certain consequences. The short term we'll win, but in the long term we'll lose. Right? So I still felt it was a little bit theoretical. So I asked another person, you know, recently who was in a corporate setting for a very long time. So I put this conundrum in front of them. What could that lady have done? And he said, in practice, right, this is true, that, and it came from a personal experience that person had, you know, that it is very right to communicate to the boss in that sense, that, you know, that I feel that this action will result in a short-term result, but in the long term, it may impact us. And he gave a very nice illustration from an event that happened. So this was in one of the states of India. They were bidding for a very high value project. You know, it would be windfall profits for the company. And at what happened somewhere in the discussions, one of the junior secretaries in the government,
mm-hmm.
what he did was he intentionally leaked the quotations which are from the several companies. He leaked it to one of the competitors of this particular company because he wanted some favor from them, you know. So he would have got some cutback probably. And these people got to know, this particular company, they got to know. And they said, you know, we should somehow entice that particular junior secretary, right? And this devotee, what he told me was that he spoke to the boss. He said that I feel, you know, that there is a better reward waiting for us if we take the ethical line, right? And therefore, I would recommend not to do this particular act. And so the boss, he said, okay, you do what you like, you know, so it's up to you. And he says that as it turned out, there is some mistake that was made by the other competitor in noting down the price. Totally, you know, so it resulted in, you know, this, the order luckily falling into their lap. But he said that it wasn't the consequence, the final consequence is incidental, that it luckily turned out the way it turned out. But he said what is very important is communication. You are able to carry that other person along with you when you say that this is my stand, that I'll stand for ethics.
Right.
Usually what we do is we cut the other person off and leave them feeling, you know, that as if they have a criminal bent of mind.
Right.
And that is the mistake. That is what injures that other person. Not that you take a stand for ethics. The injury happens when you cut the other person off and say, kind of, you know, demean them saying that you are not a person capable of following ethics. So that we should watch out for.
Absolutely. I think, you know, many times when I think of it, it's like what happens within our head if we can make it happen, you know, public life or in a corporate scenario, because, you know, it happens in our head. It's not like we are always very clear that no, I can't do this because it's unethical. There is a debate happening in our head.
True.
There is one part of us saying that no, I mean, let's get done with this. This is easier this way. But then the ethical part prevails, right? The same thing what happens, I mean, we do not, how it is wrong when individually we start saying that, oh God, I have got this thought and I condemn myself for this. I think the same thing, how it is unhealthy to do that as an individual practice, is the same thing even in a communal scenario, or in a scenario where it's a group of individuals, where if we can think that, you know, this is one part of me who is saying that let's take this shortcut, and there's one part of me which is saying that no, this is the ethical thing, the same debate and explanation and prevailing which happens in the head, if it can happen outside,
true.
I think that's when we move forward. It's
correct.
Healthy for an individual as well as healthy for an organization too.
Absolutely.
So I think we'll go to the next clip in that discourse where Swami continues with that very theme of how dharma is more important, how honor is something which is more important, and how the Indian culture actually taught that this very principle.
Vyasa and Valmiki were sages.
భగవత్ తత్వాన్ని శ్లోక రూపములో ధరింపజేసి జగత్తులకు ఈ విధమైనటువంటి విజ్ఞాన ధర్మములను ప్రకటింపుతూ.
The divine principle which is the source of this world was presented in the form of verses, and thus they have propagated righteousness and knowledge in the world.
కానీ వీరు రాసినటువంటి పురాణములు పురాతనమైనటువంటివి.
But the scriptures written by them are quite ancient.
ఇవి పురాతనమైనటువంటి యొక్క నీతులు కనుకనే దీనికి పురాణములని కూడాను పేరు వచ్చింది.
As these are ancient codes of conduct, they are also referred to as Puranas.
భారత రామాయణములు భారతదేశమునకే కాక యావత్ ప్రపంచమునకు కూడాను ఆదర్శవంతమైనటువంటి ధర్మమును ప్రబోధిస్తూ వచ్చింది.
మహాభారత and Ramayana have been teaching the ideals of dharma not only to India but to the entire world.
ప్రాచీన కాలము నుండి అన్ని దేశములకు సుస్థిర శాంతి భద్రతను చేకూర్చుకుంటూ వచ్చినటువంటిది ఈ భారతీయ సంస్కృతియే.
Since ancient times, that which has been ensuring fortune, peace and security for all countries is this Indian culture.
ఎట్టి భేదము ఎట్టి విధమైనటువంటి యొక్క సంబంధము కలగనప్పటికీ లోక సమస్త సుఖినో భవంతు అన్నటువంటిదే ఆర్య సాంప్రదాయములో ప్రధానమైనటువంటి యొక్క ఏకత్వంతో కూడినటువంటి యొక్క దివ్యమైనటువంటి మంత్రము.
Whether there were no differences or relationships, praying for the welfare of all in the world, Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu, was the primary divine mantra suffused with the principle of unity that belonged to the Aryan tradition.
Dese kala vastu prabhavamunu ye matram kodanu anusarinchaka samastamu ekatvanga bhavinchi divyatmanga visheshinchi ప్రబోధించినటువంటి యొక్క ప్రచారము ఇది.
దిస్ వాజ్ ద మెసేజ్ దట్ వాజ్ టాట్ వితౌట్ గివింగ్ ఎనీ కన్సిడరేషన్ టు ఆస్పెక్ట్ సచ్ ఎస్ కంట్రీ, టైమ్, మెటీరియల్ అండ్ బిహేవియర్, కన్సిడరింగ్ ది వన్నెస్ ఇన్ ఎవ్రీథింగ్ అండ్ రికగ్నైజింగ్ ఆల్ యాజ్ డివైన్.
నేను నావారు అన్నటువంటి యొక్క సంకుచిత భావమును త్యజించి లోక సమస్త సుఖినో భవంతు సర్వులు కూడా సుఖంగా ఉండాలనేటువంటి విశాలమైనటువంటి యొక్క విజ్ఞానాన్ని ప్రబోధించినటువంటిది భారతీయ సంస్కృతి.
గివింగ్ అప్ నారో మైండెడ్నెస్ ఆఫ్ మీ అండ్ మై పీపుల్, విష్ ఫర్ ఎవ్రీవన్ ఇన్ ద వరల్డ్ టు బి హ్యాపీ, దిస్ మెగ్నానిమస్ మెసేజ్ వాస్ గివెన్ బై ఇండియన్ కల్చర్.
ఈ ధర్మమును పురస్కరించుకుని సకల భోగ భాగ్యములు కలిగినటువంటి సకల సంపత్తితో అర్థబలము, అంగబలము, జనబలము, భుజబలము, బుద్దిబలము ఉండినటువంటి దుర్యోధన దుశ్శాసనాదులను ఏమాత్రము అభిమానించక కేవలము వ్యాసుల వారు ధర్మదునే అభిమానించటంలో ఉండినటువంటి అంతరార్థమేమి?
ఇన్ స్పైట్ ఆఫ్ ఆల్ ద రిచెస్ అండ్ ఫార్చ్యూన్, ద పవర్ ఆఫ్ వెల్త్, ఫిజికల్ స్ట్రెంగ్త్, పర్సనల్ పవర్ అండ్ ఇంటెలెక్చువల్ అక్యుమన్ దట్ దుర్యోధన, దుశ్శాసన అండ్ అదర్స్ పొసెస్డ్, వై డిడ్ వ్యాసా డిస్రిగార్డ్ దెమ్ and acclaim dharmaja?
మహర్యులు ధర్మమే ప్రధానమనేటువంటి లక్ష్యమును తీసుకుని ఈ జగత్తు కంట కూడాను ధర్మము ఆధారం వలనే ఈ జగత్తు నడవబడుతున్నదనేటువంటి సత్యాన్ని గుర్తించి సమస్త భారతీయ కర్మములన్నీ కూడాను ధర్మం పైన కుదింపబడి ఉన్నవనేటువంటి సత్యాన్ని గుర్తించి ఈ వ్యాసుల వారు ధర్మజుణ్ణి అభిమానిస్తూ వచ్చాడు.
The great ones of yore took dharma as the ultimate goal. They considered the truth that the whole universe functions on the basis of dharma. And they realized that all actions pertaining to the Indian culture are dependent on dharma. Hence, Vyasa honored dharmaja.
Yavat prapanchamunake niti nijayatulunu prabodhinchinatuvanti Ramayanamu prati kutumbamunaku prana samanam.
Ramayana, which taught to the entire world morality and ethics, is like life breath for every family. In a family, how should brothers live together? How should one submit to the command of a father and behave? With what sort of attitude of tolerance should a husband and wife experience their relationship?
ఈ విధంగా కుటుంబమునకు సంబంధించినటువంటి యొక్క సన్నిహిత సంబంధ బాంధవ్యాన్ని చక్కగా నిరూపించినటువంటిది రామాయణము.
In this way, it is Ramayana that explains the nuances that are involved in and related to a family.
అన్నదమ్ములలో ఉండేటువంటి ఐకమత్యమును, అనురాగ సంబంధమైనటువంటి యొక్క ప్రేమతత్వమును, కుటుంబమునకు ఏ విధమైనటువంటి యొక్క సత్కీర్తిని గావించుకుంటూ వచ్చినటువంటి యొక్క సత్యాన్ని వివరించినటువంటిది రామాయణం.
The unity among brothers, the love principle associated with relationships of affection, and how one can bring good reputation to a family, that which elucidates such truths is the Ramayana.
Ilanti Ramayanamunaku data srishtikarta Valmiki.
The giver and creator of such a Ramayana is Valmiki.
Sakala saubhagyamulato velasulunnatvanti Ravanudu.
Ravana, who flourished with all prosperity, he had no dearth of pleasure and prosperity. A match for him cannot be found in this whole world. Lanka city can make one forget even the heavens.
అట్టి రావణుని పైన వాల్మీకి అభిమానము చూపక రాజ్యమును త్యజించి ఆకులలుములు మేసి అడవులలో జీవిస్తూ తాపసవేషమును ధరించి కేవలము జీవితమును గడుపుతున్నటువంటి రామునిపైననే అభిమానము చూపటంలో ఉండేటువంటి యొక్క అంతరార్థమేమిటి?
వాట్ ఈస్ ద ఇన్నర్ సిగ్నిఫికెన్స్ ఆఫ్ వాల్మీకి నాట్ షోయింగ్ మచ్ రెస్పెక్ట్ టు సచ్ అ రావణ and holding in high esteem Rama, who, giving up the kingdom, wearing leaves and barks, was living in a forest, wearing the garb of a renunciant?
Ramudu dharma swarupudu.
Rama is the embodiment of dharma.
Taanu chesinatunti prati okka pani kudanu dharmamayamaintunteve. Taanu palikina prati paluku satyaswarupame.
Each and every action he performed was dharmic. Every word uttered by him was verily truth.
తాను పెట్టిన ప్రతి అడుగు కూడా ధర్మం పైననే పడుతూ వచ్చింది.
ఎవ్రీ ఫుట్ స్టెప్ ఆఫ్ హిస్ వాస్ బేస్డ్ ఆన్ ధర్మ.
కనుకనే రామో విగ్రహవాన్ ధర్మ అన్నాడు.
దట్ ఇస్ వై ఇట్ ఇస్ సెడ్ రామ ఇస్ ది ఎంబాడిమెంట్ ఆఫ్ రైచియస్నెస్.
కనుక ఈ మహర్షులు ధనకనక వస్తువాహనాదులపైన అభిమానములు చూపక భుజబల బుద్ధిబలంపైన అభిమానము చూపక ధర్మము పైననే అభిమానం చూపుతూ రావటంలో ఉండినటువంటి అంతరార్థం ఏమిటి?
So what is the inner significance of our sages giving no regard to money, gold and material, disregarding physical or intellectual prowess and holding in esteem only dharma?
Jagatunaku manava jeevitamunaku manava lokamunake dharmame pranamu dharmame aadharamu aneetunte satyanni guttimpa chestu vacharu.
They kept reminding the truth that dharma is the very life and basis for the existence of this world, for the whole of humanity and human life.
So that was the next clip in that discourse, and as we pointed out, Swami takes on from that point which he made last time, where he spoke about how righteousness is a means of studying how well a society is functioning. That if people are conscious about their duties, and when a society is ideal in that manner, it will show up in prosperity and in the welfare of the citizens that live in that society. And Swami takes on from there, and Swami makes a reference to two of the epics which pretty much define the moral code in the Indian society, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. Right. Swami speaks of Vyasa and Valmiki, the authors of those two texts. That's how that clip begins.
Yeah, and actually Swami has spent entire summer courses itself on the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. In the 2002 summer course was exclusively on the Ramayana. Yeah, because ideals, you know, that is what Swami is to hold in front of all the students. And different ideals you see in the Ramayana and a different set of ideals you see in the Mahabharata. In fact, the Mahabharata, you could say, is a little more complex in the study of ethics. Like, Ramayana is pretty much, you know, it's very stark in the sense, like, what it tells you. But Mahabharata has a lot of nuances. Because you see Lord Krishna right in the middle, like, doing things which could have, which could appear contradictory in the light of dharma. Lord Rama has fewer such instances. Though, if you actually listen to the scholars and, you know, being in Prashanthi Nilayam, you listen to a lot of scholars who can pick up very tiny nuances, you know, of events that take place in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. It is astonishing the amount of lessons that they can pick out, you know, like, that's why Swami used to have us students, you know, derive the benefit of listening to such scholars. Because what we learn is, like, given the limited time, we have read certain editions of the English editions of the Ramayana, like that authored by Rajgopalachari, etc. So with that we know what we know. But if we actually go deeper into not only the Valmiki Ramayana, there are those inspired by that who translated or have interpreted the Ramayana in different languages too. And each one brings out a different, you know, like, it's like a prism, right? You, a different color from, or a halo of colors from the Ramayana. And that is why Swami holds these as ideals in front of these students. Because as he says over here, he just gives literally the definition of Indian culture. And he says, without yielding to the conditions of place, time and situation. So, regardless of the circumstances, Indian culture has always sought the underlying unity in the apparent diversity by renouncing the narrow feelings of I and mine. As Swami made clear even in the last discourse, that first you must have the understanding. It is not mere practice. So that is, I think, the cause of a lot of strife today. Right? Because when Swami calls on us to be, you know, respectful of all religions or respectful of various ways of modes of thinking, etc., what happens is we say, yes, we will do that. Right? But at some point of time, it collides with our like individual ways of thinking, right? Which may not be that expansive. And that's why Swami says that importance he gives to understanding the source from where it comes. And Swami says that we should always seek the underlying unity in that apparent diversity, and how that is not the entire thing, you know, by renouncing the narrow feelings of I and mine. So we should recognize that the where does it come from? That feeling of diversity, that feeling of otherness, it originates first in your notion of you being a separate person. And Swami says you must be in the quest of whether that is an illusion or what is it. And that is when the rest of it will automatically flow.
Right. And going to both these epics, you know, as you said, there are a lot of stark differences between the two. As one of the mythologists puts it, he said the real difference in that sense is, you know, here you have Rama who is the ideal, and then you have Ravana who cares, does not care for the moral code of conducts. So it's easy to see a black and white, a contest between black and white. But if you come to Mahabharata, you have the character of Duryodhana and his brothers aided by his uncle. And if you look at his personality, he pretty much does some things which is legally correct. You know, it will come under the law books as, yes, it is permissible, but ethically wrong. You know, you could see that he, all the time, he does not follow the spirit of the law. So he, and, you know, that's why they say it's more easy to relate to the Mahabharata, because a lot of what we do today is similar to what happens in the Mahabharata.
Exactly. Like, if you see the main protagonist, the person who is held as the embodiment of dharma is also given to gambling.
Right.
You know, so I think the that character is therefore somebody relatable. On the one hand, it is, when you look at Lord Rama, you're looking at perfection. Right, and so the usual state in which we look at Lord Rama is therefore admiration, as a person who is way beyond our, we are beyond our reach, and that absolves us of a certain responsibility, because we can say that was God and God behaves perfectly, right? That's why in the Mahabharata, however, there are so many such characters. With each one of us, we can identify in one way or the other, right? There is some weakness that we have. In some ways, we are. Pretty much, you know, we can say confidently, yes, we are strong in this area. In some other areas, we are so very weak. And that's why the characters in Mahabharata are actually struggling, just as we are struggling, right? To be that paragon of virtue, as because they have the Lord in their immediate vicinity and they're aware that He is a Lord. That is one difference which scholars point out between Ramayana and Mahabharata, is that in the Ramayana, at that time they were not aware, because the Lord Rama himself would behave in such an ordinary fashion that even Vishwamitra, you know, he teaches them the mantras that Abala and Abala, and it takes a sage of that, ability to recognize that even that is a folly, that he's teaching Lord Narayana himself. Right? But most of the ordinary folk were not aware of the extraordinary person with whom they were dealing with. Whereas the Pandavas had recognized Lord Krishna's divinity, because he had, from his childhood, there were so many such incidents which marked him as a completely different person. Right? And so you are in the presence of divinity and you are struggling with whatever follies you have imbibed over time. And that folly, that struggle with that folly is what, makes the Mahabharata so very relatable, right?
The other thing which Swami points out here, especially when he's talking about the characters of Mahabharata, he kind of puts it in such a way that the author is pretty much unforgiving to the characters who probably we might think there's nothing wrong in what they did, you know, probably a character like Karna. Actually speaking, the text of Mahabharata is quite critical about his role which he plays. You know, though he is praised in parts for his nature, his charitable nature, but it clearly says that he's on the wrong side. You know, he is not to be emulated. That's something which is very clearly said. Because what Swami is saying, that finally it all goes down to giving importance to dharma. That you could be doing everything, but if you are eventually at the end of the day, you're not dharmic, if you're not on the side of dharma, you lose out on the importance which you get. So Swami is giving the comparison of Rama does not being, you know, in that battle between Rama and Ravana, Rama seems to be, he has lost his kingdom, he's been thrown out of his kingdom, he's living in the forest like a mendicant. And here is Ravana who seems to have everything. But Swami says, why is Valmiki so unforgiving when it comes to Ravana? Why is he praising Rama? Swami says it's all because of dharma. And same is the case with the Mahabharata also. But the importance of seeing it in the right light, as someone is saying, you know, we have these Dravidian parties down south, and there is always this debate of Aryan versus Dravidian, a theory which has been given. And a lot of people cast the entire Ramayana in that context, where it was the Aryans coming and invading the Dravidians, and that's what the Ramayana is all about. A little bit of reading into the Ramayana itself, forget about the scientific evidences and that of the other studies which are coming up. A little bit of reading the Ramayana itself will tell you that it's not something which you can go by. And it goes to such an extent that some of the, you know, these strong Dravidian fundamentalists, they started celebrating Ravana as their champion. Mm-hmm. And that the epics have shown him in bad light to show the South Indians in bad light and all that. Mm-hmm. And somebody pointed out that you just have to go back and read the Ramayana, you will realize that actually Ravana does not belong to the south. He belongs to, you know, his origins is somewhere in the north, and he comes and snatches away Lanka from Kubera. So it's not like he was a born Dravidian and Rama was an Aryan. And that importance of reading the text itself, you know, when you just buy an argument which comes by and you try to build a narrative on that. And the fortunate thing for us is Swami rewriting the Mahabharata, right? The Ramayana, the Ramkatha Raswani. In fact, when we were going through that, we were making a reference to this. When you see a depiction of the Ramayana, either a televised version or even if you see some of the modern writings, you would see that the childhood phase of Rama is actually run through. Literally a few episodes of that, and you know, Rama is already ready to go to the forest, right? And a lot of emphasis is given on the war part. If you just look at Swami's Ramkatha Raswayani, the Ramkatha Raswayani part 1 is a thick book, and the Ramkatha Raswayani part 2 is actually a much thinner book than the first part. The first part completely emphasizes on the way Rama, you know, behaved towards his father, the way he lived for the forest, the altercation which happens between Rama and Bharata. Literally Swami saying that this is the important part of the Ramayana, where, you know, the moral obligations of an individual is very clearly put forward. The war part, the fight part, is probably a climax which was meant to be, and you know, we all know that that is the backdrop of this entire story, where Ravana has to be vanquished, and you know, the Jaya Vijaya, the story and all that. But the learning part is in that first part, where Rama says that, you know, this is my role as a king, and this is what I need to do, I have to listen to my father. And the way that debate happens between Bharata and Rama, the emphasis which Swami gives on that part itself suggests what Swami is telling here, that Valmiki meant to showcase that, as that is the ideal that we all need to carry when we go through the text.
Yeah, because the primary importance of dharma, finally both the epics are all about the aspect of dharma. In fact, Swami says over here that the cosmos exists only on the power of dharma, that all beneficial acts emerge from dharma. So that's a very nice statement to build, you know, the necessity of dharma itself. Swami says that it is because of this that the sages considered dharma above everything else. Right? Because as we are saying, you know, Swami has said that the Indian culture rests on what? On not yielding to the conditions of place, time and situation and holding on to these. And Swami also has mentioned this in a previous discourse. And here is the reasoning that Swami says. The cosmos itself exists only on the power of dharma. In other discourses, Swami would point out that, you know, the sun did not stay in its course, or the planets did not do what they were expected to do.
Right.
Or, you know, if anything, if you look at now the, say, the chairs that we are sitting on, right, if they are not put together properly, right, if they do not perform their function, or imagine the person who's the carpenter who has put it together, if he has not done his dharma properly, that would impact our lives.
Right.
And so what does it mean? That means dharma essentially is that what a person expects out of something, like, you know, that happens with complete integrity, right? And the same way for a person, right? If I can rely on prem for something and prem does not deliver that, right? This is the expectation that I have of prem, a reasonable expectation, and you do not deliver that, and that, the moment that happens, we feel that, you know, something is off.
Right.
Right. And that is why Swami says that everything in the world is proceeding according to a certain order. And then here you come. Right. You give your word for something, or you're as a son, or as a daughter, or as a husband, or as a wife, as an employee, or a citizen of this country. There are certain expectations written, communicated, uncommunicated, and you do not follow those, at that moment you are already destroying that particular order, and therefore being out of dharma, and therefore promoting the chaos in this. So that is the central importance and the lesson that nature itself teaches in that sense. Like, you know, there's a certain, everything has a certain dharma, and everybody is following it, and therefore you must too, because the moment you don't, you are creating chaos in your vicinity or in the larger vicinity.
Right. And it's a beautiful thing, the reference which you're making, because, you know, to do anything, to even follow our own passions, to follow our own profession, we are so dependent on others.
You know,
you and I cannot be sitting and talking here if we don't feel that somebody is going to listen to us.
Exactly.
You know, I don't know how to put that, because you need someone to value your work or to value your effort. For anybody, it's not just for someone who's in that sort of a business, where in the media or something like that. You know, even if you're a farmer, unless there are people who are going to depend on you, your profession actually has no meaning. And as you said, the perfection in playing the role that each one has to play has to be done by people around you for you to lead a good life. And the whole idea of dharma is, you know, you cannot control what is outside you, but you can play your part. Just like how you are dependent on others, to realize that others will be dependent on you, and all that you can do for a starters is do what you are supposed to do as perfectly as you can.
Exactly.
And that's the whole idea of dharma itself. And the whole, at least the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, it becomes more clear there, I think, probably because we can relate to it more. As you're saying, that, you know, there are more complex characters in that than, you know, very idealistic ones. Where you can see that each one is constantly asking, you know, what is my role in it? Even when you find a fight between the Pandavas.
Absolutely. Right.
It is not like they completely agree with each other.
Correct.
At the end of the day, you know, they might have a fight or a altercation, but at the end of it, we have to listen to our brother. You know, as a younger brother, this is my role. I've placed my displeasure in front of him. I've expressed my anger. But at the end of it, I'll follow what you say, because that's the role I have to play.
Which is a very important point you brought out, that dharma is not something that is set in stone.
Right.
Because the moment you said that, constantly asking, that is the important thing. That it is not something that gets resolved with one discussion or with somebody. Because when we talk to students or we talk to people, they ask, what is my dharma in this particular situation?
Right.
And it is such a difficult question to answer, because precisely because we are not in, you know, in that particular situation. You are present in that situation.
Right.
As a person, it is you who is in, it is you who is in that situation. And there are a lot of questions that you need to answer for yourself. And that is why you know, the path of inquiry, right? Who are you? Who are you? That at various levels it answers, you know, that question.
Right.
So depending on your answer to who you are, your actions, your thoughts, behavior, everything is now dictated by that. And thereby your dharma flows, right? And there is also that question that, you know, when I act, at that particular moment, right, how do I know whether it is dharma or adharma? Because if you go to an ethicist, he will present so many moral dilemmas that there are absolutely no right answers to it.
Exactly. Right.
Right. And so people ask, you know, am I flouting my dharma here? Am I not flouting my dharma here? All you have to do is act consistent with your image of who you are, A, and keep improving that answer, you know, as to who you are.
Right.
Keep constantly keep questioning that. So seek the guidance of the masters like Swami as the ultimate guru. And we have so many, India has had the fortune of having so many masters. Like you got Ramana Maharishi, Nisargadatta Maharaj, and so many people who can keep on, you know, answering that question, whether we can accept it in our experience or our intuition or not, right? But that is a very important thing to do. The path of self-inquiry is therefore very consistent or correlated with following the path of dharma.
Right.
They cannot be separated.
Exactly. I think the ultimate would be, as Swami would say, that constant integrated awareness, where at every moment you are aware of what you are supposed to do.
True.
I think till we get there, I guess it's constant inquiry or constant vigilance of what you're supposed to do, what
vigilance
you're doing.
Is the right word. Yes.
Right, you know?
Right.
I think this should lead to that, that awareness should be got through the process of this constant questioning and being vigilant. I think this is precisely what's the rest of the discourse is going to be about. It's going to be about dharma, and it's going to be about the importance Indian culture gives to dharma, and precisely what gives Indian culture itself its value. Is it's the importance the Indian culture gives to dharma. I think that's what the rest of the discourse is going to be. So dear listeners, we hope you'll join us again for the rest of the discourse. We most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet, and we thank you all for joining us. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next episode of today's this Thursday's live broadcast. We'll join you again in the next episode of Shravanam Mananam Dasanam. Thank you. Jai Sainam.